Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we have the privilege of speaking with Courtney Tyler. Courtney is the founder of Hips and Haws Wildcrafts, based in the Wicklow Mountains of Ireland. Hips and Haws is a project all about wild food, fermentation, folk herbalism, fungi, foraging, and wildcrafting, which is the practice of making food or medicine from plants and mushrooms sourced from the wild. She's a keen forager and spends much time wandering the hedgerows and forests of Ireland, searching for wild edibles to preserve as food or medicine, or to add to her collection of fermented food and drink. She passes on her knowledge through foraging walks and tours, workshops, crafting, and recipes. Her passion, knowledge, and her clarity in explaining and sharing her excitement inspires us all to rekindle our connection to the wild around and within us. Courtney, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Darren. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I'm excited to dive into foraging in Ireland, because that's not something that I've had any guests on about. And I think for everyone, we all have a special place in our heart for the island of Ireland, because there's so much mythology and beautiful culture that comes from there. So it's really a pleasure to be able to talk to someone who has communed with the natural spaces there in Ireland. And I guess, what got you into exploring the wilds within and around you? You know, what made you so ensconced with the natural world there in Ireland to start foraging and developing that connection?
That's a good question. I get asked that a lot. And I wish I could say that I had this romantic childhood and my granny brought me out to the fields, and I kind of really dreamed that that was my story, but it was late in life that I found this connection. And I think I was really suffering from a lack of connection in many areas of my life. And, you know, I've heard the story quite a lot of maybe sometimes struggling with anxiety or depression, and how the impact it can have of being outside in nature and reconnecting just to the silence, the peace, the tranquility, and later the connection, and one by one kind of feeling more comfortable and at home in that space, and how much that inspired me as well. So it was later in my journey in recent years, but yeah, the impact is profound, and it's woken this huge passion to share that, invite others in any way I can to kind of reconnect in small ways, step by step.
Yeah, the profound effect on mental health and a sense of well-being is undeniable. And that's whether I talk to people who at first were seeking that kind of outlet, you know, they wanted to get out in the natural world to have that kind of nature therapy, or if there was someone who was into wild foods, got kind of addicted to finding delicious food in the wild, and then realized how much it was helping with anxiety and with, you know, different issues that we're afflicted by in a modern culture that's kind of bombarding us from a lot of different angles with information and emotions that maybe humans aren't perfectly adapted for, or we're in the process of getting adapted to. So that's something that's undeniable. And when we talk about wild food, how did you get started on that journey? You know, was it through mushrooms? Was it through wild plants, or maybe something else entirely?
I'd always had an interest in herbal medicine and healing naturally. I did a naturopathy course 20 years ago in Dublin, and always had a dream and passion for connecting more with plants as medicine. Due to circumstances in my life at the time, I was a single parent to a young and wild, eccentric boy who is full of life and vitality, much more than one child should be. And I had my hands full. I was doing this course, and his father passed away very suddenly due to a brain hemorrhage, and just found myself in a country that I wasn't born in with a young child on my own. And I had been doing that course, and I was really gratefully kind of spongy, soaking up all this. We studied medicine, anatomy and physiology, and then herbal medicine, acupuncture, things like that. And that's always been my preferred method of medicine, you know, and as natural as it could be. You know, I yearn for the knowledge and connection to heal myself and the people close to me, my family, my son, with these methods. And I had to put that on hold, I think, for quite a long time. I was living in Dublin in a very urban setting. My mind was very busy and hectic. I was quite scattered. I thrived in my professional life and I could do everything I needed to for my son, but I wasn't very connected to the nature and world around me. And in later years, came back to that space where I felt like I could really reconnect and dedicate some time and energy to learning those things more deeply. I suppose I lived in Dublin for 16 years and about 9 years ago moved to Wicklow, which is just an hour south of Dublin. And it's a very special place, Wicklow. It's got mountains, it's got the sea, it's got forests. It's called the Garden County of Ireland. So there's a lot of great natural beauty. And the most heavily forested part of Ireland, where most of Ireland has lost its trees and forestry through massive deforestation over a long time. So Ireland has a little special kind of niche of wildness. And first, my interest was herbal medicine. Then it became wanting to find those herbs around me. I had no interest in buying herbs from China or the other side of the world. I wanted to use what was around me. It was a long time later, though, that it was mushrooms. I remember, obviously, on my walks and explorations, as I seeked out the plants that could nourish me or heal me, I saw mushrooms along the way, but I completely wrote them off. I felt very intimidated and scared. There's a lot of mycophobia, and it runs very deep, I think, in our culture, just this fear of the unknown and just knowing that they could kill.
Right.
So it was a very conscious decision years later to kind of, I thought long and hard about it. Did I have the mental attention and capacity to focus in on something that I knew required great attention to detail?
Yeah.
I decided to dive in and realized through that process that I have the kind of mindset that loves to focus in on something minutia, that are these details. I think I can acknowledge more and more that I'm probably on the ADHD, ADD spectrum. And I think that I notice these qualities in a lot of my peers. I think the ability to hone in and focus on such tiny details as you need to for the mushroom world, I kind of see these qualities in a lot of people. So it woke up this passion in me, and the level to which I dove in was extreme. I live, breathe and eat mushrooms and fall asleep with mushroom books every night. And I'm just hook, line and sinker, fascinated.
That was something I was going to ask you, is if foraging and this relationship with wild plants and then wild mushrooms was more of this passionate hobby for you, or if it became kind of a lifestyle. And it very much sounds like now it's integrated and this is kind of a core pillar of your lifestyle there in the Wicklow Mountains.
Yeah, it is. I think the connection to the seasons, kind of reconnecting to, I think time just passed me by. I think I wasn't really noticing or connecting to the things around me if I look at my busy Dublin life and my previous years. But one by one, as I walked through the forest, I remember when it was just a sea of green and I couldn't identify many trees, or apart from dandelions or nettles, I just saw green, really. But one by one, as these things kind of revealed themselves to me and as I focused in, it just felt so exciting to realize there was so much to learn and connect to. And one by one, they start revealing themselves to me. And I do say revealing to me because I had this, I don't know, I think I do hear some people say it, but then I also think it sounds quite eccentric. But as I'm seeking out a certain plant that I really want to find, I might have read about it and researched it, but not yet found it, and really kind of to seek it out. And I'm driving down the road and I will see something out of the corner of my eye and it calls to me. I need to stop and pull over the car. And I was driving really fast. There's no way I could have seen it. But it's absolutely the thing I was looking for. And I really feel that about mushrooms as well. It's almost like they're talking to me, calling to me. And
I think a lot of us feel that way. And speaking with one of my friends who's also a forager, isn't it more fun to think of it that way? Isn't it more fun to think that these organisms are reaching out to us, are trying to get our attention? And certainly I know a lot of us have felt that way about elusive mushrooms. And of course, it would be the same about elusive plants. And you mentioned that you know, Ireland was not your home. You actually were from the States originally. So obviously you lived a professional life there in Dublin for years. But when you moved out to the country and reconnected with herbal medicine, with foraging. Do you think that actually helped you develop a stronger bond with what is, you know, not the land of your birth? Do you think that really helped you understand and feel a sense of belonging there in Ireland?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I kind of wrote a mind map out earlier in anticipation of our call, and I was reading over the outline you'd sent me, and I was kind of just thinking about your questions and pondering, and I started the center of the mind map with connection and mycelium and all the ways it's kind of infiltrated around to connect me to so many things. And as it does, it connects the whole world in a million ways, but certainly the connection to nature, the connection to myself, community I find around me, I have a really much stronger sense of community and admiration for the people that surround me and the seasons, and also to my tribe, what I see as my tribe. I mean, I think sometimes I've felt a bit of an outsider or can feel a bit nerdy, the stereotypical interest in fungi. But as I connect with people who share these passions, I kind of just feel this immense gratitude for amazing community and people that are around me and to this land. And today's a very special day in Ireland. It's Imbolc. It's February 1st. It's the start of the first stirrings of spring. And it's St. Bridget's Day, or Goddess Bridget's Day, actually. There's a lot of festival around fertility and around this, the new growth, the shoots. The greens are starting to pop up their heads again. So as a forager, it's quite an exciting time. To all my favorite wild greens are going to appear just around the corner.
Well, when I think of Irish culture, I think in a people steeped in connection with the natural world and appreciation and basically worship of the natural world and natural cycles all around us. And you just invoked there the goddess Bridget and Imbolc. I mean, has that legacy of kind of folklore, and then kind of expanding out, the word folklore implies it's not real. And I think so much of it is grounded in a real appreciation of actual natural processes, not necessarily something completely fantastical. But has that kind of tradition, that spirituality, whether we're talking about the Celts or the Druids or these rich traditions, has that influenced your own foraging practice as you've gone deeper and deeper down the forest path, if you will, into the wild?
Yeah, more and more. I think the journey first started at a very physical level, you know, seeking out a certain plant that I thought, you know, could have medicinal qualities, but that evolved to first just the physical looking for it and the knowledge, and the kind of moved on to the more spiritual awakening, I suppose, of the connection to these things. And yeah, I feel more and more connected. And especially, I guess, the seasonality to me is really beautiful. And that's where the Celtic festivals come into play, because it's all based around the solstices and the equinoxes and these marked changes in season and the tradition that comes around those festivals. So I love the reconnection to these lost traditions and lost knowledge.
It's a fascinating study, and I'm quite envious that you get to be embedded in a culture that has so much to offer when you start going down this path and you're able to develop this sense of belonging that you have. And when we talk about seasons, just because I'm not familiar with, of course, I'm not familiar with the wild food seasons there, you know, what are the best times to forage in Ireland, or maybe just season by season? What do you look forward to? What are you wild foraging? What does that wild food seasonality look like there in Ireland?
Ireland's quite a temperate climate, which means there's not mad extremes of temperature. So there's kind of two seasons. There's the colder, darker, wetter season, and then the rest of the year that's also still a bit wet and cold. it's kind of two seasons. And I really divide it more into like lightness and darkness, because we are a bit more north than you are, so the days are quite short in the winter months, and the daylight is short, and we have very long days in the summer. So there are a few hungry periods of time, and I guess these winter months now, there's a few interesting fungi out there, but really they've all kind of died back, and I have to wait a whole nother season like the rest of the world does for them to come back. It's very difficult. But yeah, these stirrings of spring bring a lot of exciting greens as well, the first of which I have a few events booked and arranged for the end of March for wild garlic season. I think you call them ramps.
Yes.
They're in huge abundance. And it's such a potent food and medicine. And I love to show people how to safely forage for it. And we're going to wildcraft it into vinegars and salts and maybe ferment some, do whatever we can do together to kind of give people some interesting things to go home with. And there's also quite a few other nice greens popping up around that time. Nettles being something that's very important to me as well. Also huge abundance. You couldn't walk 6 feet in Ireland without tripping over some nettles. So we should listen to this. And it's a very potent superfood. And, you know, There's no point buying goji berries from China if we have like our own superfoods around us. And nettles excite me on many levels. So do dandelions. Kind of these are the kind of simple but absolutely nutritious and delicious wild foods that come in the spring, I suppose.
Now, do you think, and this is something that I feel is the case here in the US and maybe Western Europe in general nowadays, but do you think there in Ireland, despite the fact there is this long tradition of practice with herbal medicines and appreciation of nature, do you think nowadays these natural resources are underappreciated? I mean, you just talked about, we tend to outsource this idea of superfoods to something that has to be exotic. Are we underappreciating the amazing food and medicine that's right here, even in a place like Ireland that has such a rich tradition? Is it still underappreciated?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a huge resurgence and awakening, the hunger for foraging and wild food and local and seasonality, but still it's quite new. And I guess in Ireland specifically, there would be the history of the famine and the repression that happened here for such a long time. So there would be this kind of, I think for a long time, there's been this bad rap for foraged foods. You know, why would you eat nettles off the ground if you could go to the supermarket? You know, well, we don't have to do that anymore. We can just buy the food we need. And, you know, why would you want to be eating that kind of famine food? So that's something that maybe has a lingering effect from history in this island, particularly to overcome, especially since these times of COVID and lockdown. I think that we're all realizing maybe food security and there's a hunger for also just getting out into the wild. I mean, what else? We're stuck at home and times are strange, aren't they? So I can really see and feel this reverberation of interest and hunger for this connection now more than ever before.
And that's something interesting you just brought up, the stigma around the idea of eating wild foods as something that you do in dark times. Whereas for me, that kind of invokes this idea of resiliency and something that, you know, has so much value as we get more and more untethered to where our food comes from and we get more and more reliant on food systems that we don't have control of. I think what inspires people so much about wild food is the idea that, yes, you are taking your food security into your own hands. Yes, these are resources that are here in good times and in lean times that we can rely on. But I would have never have guessed that there'd be a stigma around that as something that, was seen as you only eat this during the dark times and we don't want to bring those memories back. So why would you eat? That's an interesting psychology I hadn't thought of.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was really, really strong here and still is for many. I think a lot of the older generation might still echo those sorts of sentiments. So yeah, times are changing and Ireland is an island and it's a small island off the west coast of England. So we're quite dependent on first of all, probably England and then Europe is even farther away. So our food security is definitely something we need to take a look at in Ireland and as in many places of the world. But I mean, even more so now, times of Brexit. Now that these sorts of political changes are happening, we're more and more isolated, sort of. And I think some people are just really feeling the importance of that food sovereignty.
Yeah, it goes hand in hand with the idea of political sovereignty, this idea of sovereignty on every level. And it sounds like there are wild food resources to be harnessed and develop a relationship with. And you talked about this resurgence. What kind of wild food community is there in Ireland? Are you involved in any groups or have you worked with any groups? Is it more like a decentralized network of educators like yourself who are just putting this knowledge out there? Or what does that wild food community or scene look like there in Ireland?
There's a few interesting pockets, and I don't know if I've interacted deeply with any of them yet. I do feel like Ireland is a small island, so we don't have the kind of, like, even England is quite a lot bigger than we are. And I joined the Association of Foragers over the last 18 months, and they're based in the UK. And it was really something very special for me to connect with what I consider to be my tribe, to have all these. You've interviewed a few people from there already, I think. Lisa Cutliffe and Fergus Drennan is coming on soon, and different people I know that you've already interviewed. But it's a much bigger pond for things to develop inside and have a bigger community around. Right. I do feel like it's quite niche in Ireland still. There's a lot of small pockets and not a lot of cohesion between them yet. I think particularly with fungi, it's extra niche. There's not a lot of people in Wicklow that are making fungi accessible. So I think that's where I came in and just was really lucky with time and space. I never present myself as an expert, I think, especially regarding fungi. That maybe is an accolade that takes a lifetime to acquire. But I can share what I do know and share the passion I have, and it seems to be very well received. There's such a hunger for it. So the foraging was one thing, the wild plants and things, but when I introduced fungi, it kind of really exploded for me that I could really see this interest and hunger. And it's really exciting and rewarding to dream up events and walks and just kind of think about what could be an exciting thing to present and have it book out, and people are really interested in coming along. And yeah, it's giving me great purpose and meaning. It's only quite new still. It's the last couple of years that I'm doing this, but yeah, it's beautiful to see.
And as you took on that mantle of educator, as someone who was really passionate, you saw this bubbling beneath the surface of people wanting to learn more and more like you did. Was there a moment where you felt like, okay, I'm now ready to be an educator? Or did you just kind of put yourself out there and you still maybe don't feel ready? You know, what's that been like for you to take on that mantle of educating and sharing this knowledge with others?
I love that question, because I still have this, I don't know if it's, I have, obviously I have self-confidence and I have a belief in myself. And I know that this knowledge I've acquired was hard won, right. But I still have this huge imposter syndrome. And it's really helped me to kind of, I have lots of amazing mentors, a lot of people I admire around me. I think the universe keeps providing these people that are so inspirational and supportive. I feel really quite grateful. And I guess what I keep being reminded is we all have a story to tell. We all have our own perspective and experience, and that's different to anyone else's. So as long as I can concentrate on connecting to what the knowledge I have, you know, I'm so happy to share what I do know, not to worry about all the things I don't know. But if I just think, okay, these are the things I find really fascinating, let me tell you about them. That's quite easy for me to do. And then it wasn't such a, I could get over myself, you know, the fear of kind of presenting myself as an educator or an expert in some field, just to go, these are the things that I find fascinating, let me tell you about them.
What a beautiful insight. Be passionate and share the things you do know, and don't be too worried about things you don't know, because it's going to be these contributions of people from every different perspective and angle, putting pieces in the puzzle, especially when we talk about a giant kingdom of life that science is still kind of grappling with in the early days here. It's all about contributing what you do know. So very, very well put. And then what kind of mushrooms are you finding there in Wicklow? Are there a lot of mushrooms? What are the edibles that you like? And what habitats do you find them in?
There are so many mushrooms in Wicklow. It's really exciting. I started a Facebook group called Mushroom Foraging Ireland. There wasn't one except for in Polish. There's a large Polish community in Ireland. So there were some groups in Polish that they were going, oh my God, these Irish people have got no idea. Don't tell anyone. They would go clean up the mountains and the forests. There would just be so many steps that, you know, completely ignored by the average Irish person. So yeah, slowly people like me, I still get usually greeted in Polish if I'm in the forest with my mushroom basket.
That's incredible.
Yeah, they had a good thing going. So yeah, there was only some Facebook groups in Polish, and I started the first one. There's almost 6,000 members now, which in Ireland is quite big. Really kind of mushroomed quite quickly the interest in the group. It's not a very old group, but it's a good resource. You can kind of see more locally what's popping up where and what we might expect to find, and share the knowledge amongst a large group of people. So the things I find, I think I did a really nerdy mushroom count of what I've eaten this year or what mushrooms I've eaten so far. I think there was 75 different species, which isn't massive, but I was like, oh, that's over the last 4 years. It's quite a significant amount of delicious mushrooms I've used as food or medicine.
That's a lot of edible mushrooms. Any way you slice it, that's a lot of edible mushrooms.
Yeah, I was really proud of myself. I was like, oh, I don't know how that. I thought it was maybe 25, but as I made my nerdy list, I was like, oh, that's really something else. And it's not a competition. I think it's really important to say it's really not about kind of, especially not taking any risks. I think some people can take it to those extremes, but very much for me, it was, you know, the first rule in foraging is always, you know, absolutely, you have to know exactly what's in front of you before you consider putting it in your mouth. So yeah, I just wanted to say it wasn't something I was doing carelessly or quickly. It was all slowly, one by one, you know, step by step. I have a lot of teachers, mostly books. I do learn a lot from books and just going out in the forest one by one. I think I've seen you post something recently about your mushroom key and, you know, one by one, just kind of exploring what's around us.
It's a practice that I'm trying to get better at, to kick off those blinders that might just be looking for seps or chanterelles and really try to learn about some of the things around you. And it may introduce you to some lesser known edibles, actually. You know, I know a little bit about trees in Ireland. I think the beautiful tree that I love, I think it was a show about, I'm going to forget the name of the show now. But I know a little bit about the forests in Ireland, and a tree that I love is the Scots pine. You know, but what kind of forest composition are you looking at in Ireland? And then what kind of forests are you interested in as someone who's after edible mushrooms? You know, what mixed forests are you looking at there?
Yeah, great question. I love how the journey of mushroom hunting brings us along the path of needing to learn the trees that are around us, because that's a very important part of mushroom ID. And yeah, so slowly, one by one, I'm learning and deciphering the trees as well. And I have a great love for the birch tree. That would be one of my favorites. There would be a lot of mycorrhizal associations with the birch tree. I guess there's the birch polypore, which is a medicinal antiviral medicine. And there's chaga mushrooms that have been spotted in Ireland, but very rare. My other favorite mushroom, of course, which anyone who knows me is going to see peppered throughout my social media profile, but Amanita muscaria, the fly agaric, likes to grow with Scots pine and birch in particular. So I guess also it can't be, there's a lot of forestry in Ireland and it would be a lot of spruce plantations. Usually I wouldn't really choose to go there. They're quite difficult to walk through and usually quite, I would imagine, barren. But this year in Ireland, I must show you some photographs. It was a year like I don't know if it has ever happened before. There were, especially in these spruce conifer plantations, the word got out that you needed to get up into those places this year, because from September, October, I went out on many occasions and there were more seps than the eye could see. You couldn't pick them up fast enough. There was every Eastern European in the whole country was there with their baskets. And I remember arriving to the car park into the forest and I saw a procession of Eastern Europeans with baskets, as much as they could carry, full of porcini mushrooms. And I was thinking, oh, I got here too late. There's no chance. And I kept going though. I walked up the mountain, walked in kind of getting through, you know, your eyes are nearly getting poked out. It's not a very pleasant walk through the forest in these plantations. And there's lots of small branches in your eyes and things, kind of crawling around on your hands and knees. But there were more porcini than you could pick up, that you could ever imagine in your wildest dreams. There was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them. And 2 weeks later, it was the same in that same woods, but for fly agaric. So it was like a fantasy come true, like you could never imagine. I have pictures on my social media and I can share them after, but it was like a probably once in a lifetime experience.
A magical mushroom land somehow seems in keeping with my impressions of like this mythical, magical place that is Ireland, that you would have an explosion of incredible mushrooms. And we actually may have some controversy about releasing this podcast because there may be people, I may have some very angry Irish Poles who are going to tell me that we need to keep the secret here, but that's absolutely incredible. And that is how I discovered you, actually, was the work with the infamous Amanita muscaria. So I think a lot of people know about porcini and CEP, thinking that there'd be a field of thousands of them just sets my mind alight. But likewise with Amanita muscaria. Now, how did you first get involved and start working with that mushroom, and how do you use it?
I'm so taken with this mushroom. It has consumed all of my senses. First, just visually, the beauty of this mushroom. I mean, you can't deny when you come across one, it's beckoning anyone who sees it. It's magical looking. It's bright red. It's got beautiful skirt, bright white skirt color and the stalk, and it's got the bulbous base, and it has its white warty spots. And when you see them, they nearly glow in the dark. It's so alluring and beautiful. So first of all, just such a visual attraction. And then I remember, of course, the severe caution. I mean, it's not uncommon amongst many professional mycologists, even mycologists, that I hear, don't even touch it. It might kill you.
Stigma around it, yeah.
Yeah, it's got a very powerful reputation. And it's being, kind of shocking to me that even with the knowledge that is being shared day by day of the reality. It is a very powerful mushroom that can't be denied. It has powerful toxins that can produce huge effect in the mind and body. You can vomit profusely. You can sweat. You could have amazing or scary psychedelic experiences from it, hallucinogenic experiences, entheogenic experiences. It can be a very delicious food. I think it tastes like fried chicken. It's so freaking delicious. It isn't just something that's edible but not worthwhile. When I ate it, I kind of go, this is actually one of my top most delicious favorite mushrooms to eat, of course, once the toxins have been removed.
Right. Fried chicken. I've never heard that analog, and that makes me want to eat it immediately.
Yeah. So it's important to note, that there's the spectrum of edibility, which falls across many different mushrooms and wild foods. There's a lot of times that there's special preparation needed before we consume something. We're quite used to soaking our kidney beans. They're toxic if we didn't do that.
Yeah.
Undigestible if not, and they can make us quite sick. But we're quite used to a process as simple as that. It's not so complicated to detoxify fly agaric either. It's water. Its toxins are water soluble. So if you boil and change the water, kind of boil the mushroom, slice it up and boil it in a large quantity of salted water, and maybe do that. I did it 3 times at first to be safe. The toxins are removed in the water that's being flushed out each time. And then I maybe fried it in olive oil and sea salt, and it was crispy and it was so delicious. Not a beginner's mushroom, because it is from the Amanita family, which is, my favorite genus, and there are a lot of deadly poisonous mushrooms. So this is something we really want to, as with all things, we just really need to know what we're looking at. But once, it's quite a difficult mushroom to misidentify. It's so has such striking features. So it's not usually easily misidentified, but it's surprising to what sometimes newcomers can confuse. Yeah, just it's not a beginner's thing to eat. But let's just quickly talk about the medicinal qualities of it as well, because it's one of my favorite mushrooms to use as a medicine and to teach others to use as a medicine in an external remedy for sciatica. So a simple alcoholic extract is made from the red cap of the mushroom, sliced and put in vodka, for example. And if you let that sit for a few weeks and shake it daily or shake it often, it was an old Finnish recipe from Henriette's Herbals online. And I remember having suffered many years from sciatica myself, after a serious bike accident and really at times being paralyzed from pain and couldn't move from bed. I had made this remedy, but I felt far too daunted to use it myself. But with knowledge, and I went to this conference that blew my mind, Medicinal Mushroom Conference in the UK, where a lot of people were speaking firsthand about using the mushroom in this way. And that gave me the confidence. At the time at the conference, I was suffering from sciatica. So when I went home, I had the tincture already made. And I don't like to say that things are miracles, but it has a nearly miraculous effect that's instantaneous. So a few drops on my spine near the pain, and that was it. I was like, oh, I can't quite believe it's true, but the pain is gone. And that lasted many weeks. And I reapplied the tincture again a few weeks later as I felt a little twinge, and then I didn't feel the pain for another further year. I've now shared this with many people and I hear back the same results over and over again. It doesn't work for everyone or for all pain, but it can have some near miraculous effect for many people.
I mean, what a powerful story. And myself, my wife suffers from spinal cord nerve damage. And so you just sharing that anecdote makes me immediately think I need to try this. And this is something I find with all herbal medicines, medicinal mushrooms, you know, there is kind of this built up stigma around it. I always feel the urge to say, you know, hey, this is anecdotal. For you, is that anecdotal experience of trying these things for yourself, I mean, is that the only way that people seem to really be able to appreciate these medicines?
I think there's no denying that unless we've experienced something ourselves, it's very hard to read something. We're so inundated with information online and such contradictory information. And how do you know what to trust or who to believe, or it works for someone but not for someone else? But
right.
For this, I invite you to try it. And I think that it's, as long as you can find the mushroom, it's a very simple remedy to make, and there's no harm in trying it. And again, it's not taken internally, because if you did take it internally, you would be consuming the toxins. Right. It's externally, and there could be contraindications. It's not been studied much that I know about, but I do admire forager herbalist called Monica Wild. She's actually based in the UK. She is incredible, but she is a medical herbalist as well. I think she would say that there's some contraindications if you had some certain heart conditions. So certainly something to investigate a little further. But it's external. It's 2 or 3 drops. It's such a tiny dose. It's almost like homeopathy. But yeah, very powerful.
The whole universe of mushroom medicines and herbal medicines has so many inspiring stories and so many potent life-changing events that, to me, that's undeniable. You know, if the science hasn't caught up yet, I mean, how many times throughout human history has science not caught up with what people are experiencing in reality? And, you know, as much as I always put many caveats out about medicinals and urge people to not see these as a panacea or see these as one thing that could fix anybody's ailments, you know, there are so many powerful stories like this that it makes you wonder why these applications, these herbs, these mushrooms aren't heavily, heavily researched if people are having such potent effects with them.
Absolutely. And again, I guess we're kind of saying this is a new thing, but it's obviously a very old thing. And I know you interviewed Roger Roberts and his amazing, well, he has the fungal pharmacy, which has blown my mind and been an immense source of inspiration and knowledge to me. But also, of course, this new book about Amanita muscaria and the folklore, the traditions, its traditional use throughout time and history in many cultures. It has been explored. And I'm just as confused as you are, but maybe secretly a little bit grateful too, because I guess we have the opportunity to use these things and we're not yet, I guess we don't have to buy in a pill from the pharmacy. We can have the power in our own hands. And That's hard won when we're talking about Amanita muscaria with thousands of years of repression and fear and misinformation. And it comes from a place where such a powerful thing that's so easily recognizable maybe gave people the direct communion to God, and how much that might have what's the word, intimidated the church.
Yeah. Inevitably, when we think about these things, there seems to be implicitly an understanding that the widespread use or knowledge of these substances would threaten authority figures, whether that's economic authority, political authority, spiritual authority, you know, people having direct access to natural medicines that are as potent as this somehow challenges that centralized authority. And so maybe that's the very reason why it hasn't been studied and researched and has largely been kept through decentralized networks of practitioners and educators. And then specifically about Amanita, you hinted at, you know, there's more information coming out. Do you think that's starting to shift? Because now if I post something on Instagram, there will be people telling me, you shouldn't stigmatize this mushroom. This mushroom is great. It's, you know, do you see that starting to shift as more people like yourself kind of bring us the real education on the mushroom?
I don't know. It was really interesting. I mean, so Fergus Drennan, Fergus the Forager, and myself met at the Foragers Association last year, a year ago a year ago today, I think, nearly. And we dreamt up that we both realized we had the same kind of excitement and passion for this mushroom that a lot of mycologists and other foragers we knew would not go there. You know, they'd right. rather not interact. Some might choose just to be safe and forget about all amanitas across the board and just not take any risk at all.
Which is so advice I've given people, yeah.
Absolutely. And very wise advice, especially when you're starting off. But even mycologists I know who have, one of my teachers, for example, would maybe be on the extreme end of trying mushrooms in a way that not necessarily, yeah, maybe a little bit risky. Things that, we don't know if this, what exactly are the, he would understand toxicology and not take stupid risks, but he would maybe push the boundaries a little bit on some of the things he chooses to eat. He would have eaten many Amanita mushrooms, but never fly agaric. And I found that quite fascinating. Part of it in his mind is linked to, I think, a legality issue that, you know, it's quite a gray area. I know that psilocybin is illegal and picking magic mushrooms is illegal. And in Ireland and UK, as far as I understand it, Amanita muscaria it's not illegal because obviously it doesn't contain psilocybin, but it still maybe is gray because it's psychoactive.
A fear around the legality of the mushroom. I think here in the States, it is explicitly, you know, not illegal, and picking it would not raise the ire of any authority. But that is something, yeah, we would always have to be careful of when talking about any psychoactive substance.
And I have never used Amanita muscaria in its psychoactive sense myself personally. But I have on my journey of learning more about it. And my work with Fergus, I've heard a lot of firsthand stories about people who have. And I guess I used to be very intimidated at the start. I would read everything that I would believe most things I read, and a lot of books echo each other, perhaps with a shared story of the cautions that are overemphasized. Right. Because as I understand it, there are no deaths. You'd have to eat such a quantity of Amanita muscaria raw to die from it.
I've heard much the same, that it can be responsible for horrible gastrointestinal upset, but it's not the kind of thing where you worry about death from toxicity.
Yeah. And I don't even know if it's as much gastrointestinal as you're sweating and vomiting. So I guess that's gastrointestinal, but it's not like doesn't sound like it's long lasting, you know. It certainly isn't as most books advise. It doesn't have the level of toxins that it suggests.
And it just makes you wonder, you know, with the potent effects that we're talking about, with the preparation methods you describe that aren't some incredibly intricate, you know, alchemical process. We're talking about boiling out toxins or extracting certain metabolites through alcohol and being careful all the way through. So combine that with this idea that it's not on the scale of toxic substances. It's actually not the most toxic substance you're going to find. And then these potent effects that happen through that rather simple preparation, once you understand it, it makes you wonder if there was some widespread repression by centralized authority because it threatened them somehow. And we're still living through the vestiges of that with how much the negatives is overemphasized. I just can't get away from that.
No, I totally agree with you. And it still blows my mind. And I do feel like I'm on the fringes of a slightly risky speaking out about, you know, having this event with Fergus, of which we hope to do many more together. Actually, it was beautiful. He is a huge inspiration to me, Fergus Drennan. So if you don't follow him already, you should check him out. But our event was done in his style. So it was intense and 14 hours nonstop Amanita muscaria adventures. We had just 16 people, 16 places we offered for the event, and it was held in Wicklow. I was like, shouldn't we do it over 2 days? Or, you know, 16 hours is a little bit intense. He's like, no, it's got to be intense. And and there was poetry and there was magic. There was the very lucky experience that this was 2 weeks after the SEP explosion. So Fergus and I woke up at 5 a.m. and climbed up to the spruce plantation. And we picked hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fly agarics. So we were quite lucky that just happened to line up for our event we'd planned 9 months previous. And he made fly agaric vegan ice cream. We explored how to safely detoxify the mushroom. We did that together. We tasted it in a few different forms. He also, Fergus made a hard rock candy out of fly agaric as well. And I made a Thai pumpkin hummus that had fly agaric in it as well. They were absolutely delicious, just the incredible taste sensations. And then we also made our own sciatica remedies, or there's many applications besides sciatica, but that's the one that I have heard the most results with. Everyone went home with their own tincture, and we made art. We made a mushroom mandala on the ground. It was just a beautiful day around the fire in the forest with a real ode and exploration of discussion around this mushroom. And it was just so refreshing to finally be able to speak out and share some truths and show people under what parameters things are safe, and that it's not a dangerous or eccentric thing to do, but it feels a little risky because there's a lot of repression around this knowledge. It's a little bit hard for me to understand that, how that's persisting so ferociously, the fear.
Well, and it's another example of how culturally appreciations or understandings of mushrooms, and I'm sure this applies to plants, many other things, differ so greatly. But it seems like mushrooms in particular, certain places it's considered toxic, certain places it's considered edible. And the classic story I like to tell is meeting with one of my forage heroes, David Arora, author of the famous Mushrooms Demystified, All the Rain Promises and More, having a forage event he hosted at his house in Mendocino a few years ago, and how he explained visiting Japan. Now, when he visited Japan, he went into conifer forests and saw that there were smashed seps on the ground. And he saw, you know, he saw other foragers, Japanese foragers in the woods, and wondered, how are people passing these seps? You know, why are they crushed? And on his way up the mountain he was walking up, there was a family coming down the other way with bags full of Amanita. And later on, it just so happened that he went to a place where there were other foragers processing their day's finds, and they had these bags of Amanita, and he had these bags of porcini or seps, and people, he said, were looking at him kind of like, oh, that's all you got? That's too bad. And he asked everyone, like, what is it? Why am I the only one who's collecting porcini? They're like, yeah, well, we step on them out there so people don't get the bad mushrooms. Make sure people are only getting the Amanita. And so, you know, that's a culture that understands preparation. I immediately thought of, you know, how Japanese culture does eat, you know, a certain blowfish that's poisonous if you don't take out a certain gland. So maybe they're just much more familiar with proper preparation of substances. But an example of how culturally things are treated so much differently. And maybe we're finally escaping our kind of Western European fear or stigma around this mushroom. You know, maybe it's finally the time as people like yourself are exploring more and more of these uses. And seeing that event through social media, you can't help but be blown away by the creativity. And we're talking Amanita ice cream. I think there was a sushi involved. I mean, all the different preparations were pretty incredible, pretty inspiring event.
Yeah, it was colorful and beautiful and inspirational. It was very exciting. I mean, your story there about Japan just made me reaffirm to myself that it's certainly calling to me. I mean, my favorite cuisine in the world is Japanese, and I just feel such a yearning to go there. But that story, I'm completely on board with them. I agree with them. I would step on a step any day if there was fly agarics all around.
It's just funny how something like that can flip your perspective on its head, like it did for me. Well, it sounds like a trip to Japan may be like a forage dream for you. You'd be able to be amongst the Amanita experts.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, and it would be so refreshing to just hear more people speaking out. I am sure in the world you're in, especially all the people that you're interviewing, maybe to you it's sounding like it's opening up a little bit. But I think still the massive consensus is still much around ignorance and fear, even in the face of being told and shown that it's different and this information is outdated. Its lingering effects are still kind of very potent. So yeah, I find it really interesting among my peers, and especially among people who know far more than I do. You know, I'm not a mycologist. I am a mycophile, and I'm a mycophagist, and I'm, you know, many things, but I'm not an expert or in the science of it all. But I'm blown away when professional mycologists are still echoing these fears, even when they understand the toxicology of it.
Yeah, and maybe the Amanita's time is coming. I like to think so. I mean, it's a mushroom everyone has the mental image of when you say the word mushroom. So it would only be natural that eventually we start unpacking what it really is and start learning the truth around it. So I laud your work, Fergus's work, others' work. I know there are a lot of people online even who are trying to spread this information. So it's really inspiring and exciting. But leaving Amanita briefly, I know that's hard to do because we all love Amanita muscaria. Just briefly, what are maybe some other mushrooms and maybe even plants that you use medicinally? Because I am intrigued by your background in herbalism. I think this is something that so many of us are trying to reconnect with as we grow increasingly mistrustful of pharmaceuticals and kind of the medical model that doesn't seem to be as holistic as we want it to be. What are some other examples of plants or mushrooms you would use medicinally and how you use them, with all the caveats that you're not a doctor, everyone's situation is different, consult your natural health practitioner, all that good stuff. But for you, what are some medicinal go-tos?
Let's see, there's so much. It's a difficult question, isn't it? But I guess off the top of my head, I guess in these times of I hate to keep talking about it, but we can't deny it, right? COVID now, like just this fear of viruses. And I guess I'm really inspired by elderberry and its potent, proven antiviral qualities. And this recipe was very much inspired by Fergus Drennan again, because he's someone I know who kind of really pushes the boundaries and does things no one's done before. So he took the birch polypore. This was something we also ate at our weekend event, our Fly Agaric event, and this blew my mind. It was called, his version was with sea buckthorn and birch polypore, and he called it a Myco Mangoes. I made a different variation with elderberry because I was intrigued by the antiviral properties of the birch polypore also. So a combination of the two, it involved a laborious process of boiling, slicing and peeling and boiling the birch polypore numerous times to remove some of that bitterness, because it's so extremely bitter that it's not something usually that's very enjoyable as an edible mushroom.
Right.
So I can't remember, was it maybe 15 times at least that I brought it to the boil and changed the water. So it took almost the whole of the day. It was a
more complex preparation than Amanita.
It was much more complex. And even still, after 15 boils and changes of water, there's no denying it was intensely bitter still. Mm. His Myco Mangoes didn't taste as bitter as mine did in the end still. So, but it was just really exciting for me to take something that is very medicinal, but usually quite unpalatable. And then, so after the reboiling and kind of taking away some of the bitterness, it was then boiled and simmered for a long time in a birch, in an elderberry syrup. I added some ginger as well, because ginger is also a potent antiviral. Yeah, so that boiled for and reduced down into this thick kind of gel. And then I dehydrated the slices of birch polypore. And it has this beautiful, it tastes like a jelly bear. I don't know what you call them. I can't remember. It's like a jelly. So it's a wonderful, it's not an easily accessible, obviously that kind of preparation is a little bit eccentric. It takes a long time, but
right.
Food is medicine. Those are things that inspire me. So I wasn't intimidated by the preparation process, but there's far simpler things to be doing as well that maybe won't take so much time. One of my favorite things to do is make mushroom coffees. I think in the US and Canada, that's been around a lot longer. Here, if I say mushroom coffee, people are usually taken aback, like, what on earth are you talking about? But I love kind of doing this in a group around a fire and having my cauldron or my pot above the fire and breaking in turkey tails and, you know, grating in some chaga mushroom. If I have reishi, I put that in as well. But a little bit of birch polypore, but not much because of how bitter it is.
Right.
But in particular, chaga. Chaga alone would be something I would often make a decoction of. And it's dark. It's a dark, bitter brew. This very light coffee to me. I add warm milk and honey and drink it like a coffee. But to me, that's a beautiful kind of simple, delicious medicine.
Yeah. And I like that it's integrating these things. I could see how I would integrate that into my daily routine or my daily life, whereas so many of us think of supplementation. You know, at least this is coming from my own perspective, but you think of supplementation or medicine as something kind of separate that you have to remember. I know a lot of people, we want to start on a medicinal regimen, but we kind of fall off because it's this whole separate process. So I love the way you're describing making something delicious out of it, putting it in your coffee, doing something that integrates it more easily. And then I think that's the name of the game, really, with a lot of herbal medicines, right? Is that it's something you have to be doing consistently for a long period of time to really get the benefit from.
Yeah. And I think also it doesn't need to be like, if you kind of brew up a large batch of this mushroom decoction, and by the way, you can let it simmer for a few hours on the stove and then strain it off. You can reboil that fungal material over and over, because it's hard and it's woody and there's a lot of life in it still for a long time. So I could do several successive brews before it's spent, but I might kind of reduce it down and freeze it into ice cube trays and add that to soups or stocks or sauces. There's lots of ways to consume that little and often. And I do notice a massive impact on my health personally. And I believe it's through the joint effects of medicinal mushrooms. And I believe almost all edible mushrooms are medicinal. They have immunomodulating properties. For me personally, I would have suffered from a lot of allergies in my life. Hay fever would have been debilitating my whole entire life. I think the combined effect of medicinal mushrooms and maybe bringing my immune system into stasis, the overactive immune system of allergies, yeah, kind of bringing that into stasis, and then the combination of the fermented foods that I eat, improving my gut health. I believe I have the first reprieve of my allergies I've ever had in my life. So the last 2 years, I haven't suffered from them, and it blows my mind. It was debilitating. I had to take antihistamines or I would be knocked out. I would go to the hospital sometimes from just massive reactions. It would really knock me out. So I am grateful all the time. And I really have total faith that the mushrooms and the fermented foods have made these positive changes in my life and my health.
I mean, that's the most powerful endorsement, because yes, I can read fungal pharmacy and read about the polysaccharides, the immune modulating compounds, but when someone tells me how they applied it in their life, how they integrated it into their diet or their regimen, and how the powerful effects that it had, to me, that's an endorsement that something's happening here that's worth all of our attention and, you know, our at least cursory exploration of how to use these things. And it seems like, again, that the big point is we need to find a way to integrate these things consistently and often to see the effects, because it's not a drug that you're going to take and feel an effect immediately. And I've gotten that response from people: how do I know that it's working? It's like, well, this isn't something that's so powerful in your biology that it will, you know, make you feel lightheaded or something after you drink it. It's something that is having an effect on your body. The compounds are getting integrated into your own body structure over time, and you need to keep it up consistently, and these changes will happen. And I think, as someone who has struggled with allergies myself, I'm seeing the things you're dealing with and the effect it's having. And it's a really powerful endorsement. And things like that always make me want to pursue this path more and more, even if it's still seen as something that's unverifiable. You can't help but think that there's a lot here that everyone needs to explore.
Yeah, and what a delicious way to do that, through having mushrooms in your dinner. Like, it's not a very difficult medicine to have, is it? So delicious.
No, we're not talking about taking down some nasty tasting cough syrup or something. I mean, this is delicious. There's no downside. And you just mentioned fermentation, and this is something that I think a lot of foragers inevitably end up exploring. I'm not sure why they always go hand in hand, but what have your explorations of fermentation been, and maybe what projects do you have going right now, fermenting away right now?
So my exploration of fermentation preceded foraging. So it was something that took me first. Also for a few years I think I see this pattern in my life, you know, new things come and they take me and I dive straight in, total obsesso weirdo. I stayed up, you know, you can ask my my partner, I was up often night after night, you know, not sleeping, fermenting away, or he might go away for a week. And I remember once I had a new cookbook by this friend of mine now. She's a close friend, Dervla Reynolds. She would be one of the biggest fermenters in Ireland. And I think I just was like, I'm going to do every single thing in her book, like really ridiculous. Like, I do wonder sometimes, I go, oh, this is not what everyone does. But I am still blown away by the transformation of foods. So I think I see this most clearly in fermentation processes, and it links so intimately with all of these things, p- preserving the wild harvest so that we can enjoy it through the seasons, preserving what's in our garden so that we can have this nutritious food throughout the year. But the transformational effect of the microbes that we harness, we cultivate by creating the right environment. It's not unlike cultivating wild mushrooms. You're controlling an environment, you're letting something flourish, and it has massive impact on taste and nutrition levels. And so all of that excites me. So it marries very well. For me, herbal medicine, food is medicine, foraging for wild food and fungi, they're just all a marriage of this beautiful symbiosis alchemy.
Yeah, it's hard not to think of fermentation as some kind of magic with the effects that occur just adding certain ingredients in time, and these natural processes take over and in many cases completely transform whatever you're fermenting. So, and it's just so intriguing that it's kind of this practice that's as old as human history, yet still seems like somehow the future of our relationship with food, that fermentation is still kind of this, when you talk about food science and some of the breakthroughs happening, you know, in the plant-based world, but in food in general, how fermentation is still kind of the leading edge of creating new food or deepening our relationship with food. You know, it's something that is inevitably connected with people who want to have a deeper connection with their food. And it's something that I am keen to explore more and more myself.
I know you've had speakers on your show talk about koji, but I just can't not mention the word koji. I think there's still a lot of people who are into fermentation, but not yet gone down the koji path. And for me, it's where fungus and fermentation are most intimately met, because koji is a filamentous mold, and it's used in all these amazing food processes, such as, you know, as we know, soy sauce and sake and miso. But the exciting, you know, the book Koji Alchemy and Noma Book of Ferment, the Noma Copenhagen restaurant, their book of ferments, and the kind of really cutting edge marriage of the Western world embracing koji and all that it can offer through transformation is so exciting, because I did mention how much I admire Japanese cuisine and their food processes and the way that they eat. The strong sense of tradition in those kinds of countries in the East would mean that there wouldn't have been a lot of exploration or experimentation encouraged. You know, it's very important that tradition is carried forward and things aren't changed or grown with the kind of fervor I'm seeing the West embrace koji and what it is. So Meredith Lee as well, I'm sure you've heard of her. She would be doing a lot of work with charcuterie and meat transformation with koji. So there's just so much exciting stuff there. And I was kind of late to the game. It's been on my periphery for a long time and going, I really want to grow my own. But finally, only during lockdown in the last year, did I just cook some rice and I sprinkled the spores over it and I put it in the hot press, which is like an airing cupboard in Ireland. Hot press. I know my English friends go, what is a hot press? It's just, you know, where your water boiler is and it's a warm room. And within 36 hours, I had white fluffy mycelium. It was absolutely magical and so exciting. And just to realize how simple it is that we could all do this in our home with very little special tools. We don't need anything special. You can get as fancy as you like. But then having that moldy rice to experiment with for all kinds of exciting food processes is a new level of excitement for me. I almost can't contain myself.
Well, and I love how approachable you just made that. And again, it's kind of a call to integrate these things into our own lives, because you've just laid out how easy it is, how approachable it is. And that's probably one of the most exciting things about everything we're talking about. When you talk about mushroom foraging, when you talk about starting to use basic herbal medicines, whether topically or through ingestion, when you talk about things like fermentation, these are the domain of all humans. I mean, these are things that we can all engage in at whatever level of sophistication we're at. And, you know, I see it more and more as something we're returning to as kind of this ancestral skill set that we probably should have never gotten disconnected from. And I think a lot of people are starting to realize that now. And it's really exciting. It's really exciting to see. And I think people like yourself are communicating it beautifully and really on the forefront of sharing this information and developing community around this. So It's really exciting. How is your social circle adapted to Courtney becoming this woman of the woods? You know, you're both your partner and your son, and maybe they've been there the whole time and are right there with you. But how has that changed some of those dynamics?
That's a good question. I think there's been a few incarnations of Courtney. So for many years, my life was in Dublin and I was a craft worker, jewelry maker. I made my life in a very creative way and I had an eccentric shop. And I like eccentricity. I like things that aren't normal and boring and like just plain, I don't know, whatever. It was a very steampunk inspired. There was a lot of upcycling and recycling. And it was something I was immensely proud of, kind of creating an environment that people would walk into, especially in Temple Bar, in this, the touristic hub of Dublin. I created a space in which when people entered, they'd never really entered a space like that before. And it was unusual. And it was something I was really proud of. It was a big part of my life. And as I moved to Wicklow and gave up the shop, it was a huge transition. There was a lot of social ills in Dublin that I found harder and harder to cope with. There's a huge drug problem of heroin and just an ugly underbelly of social ills that don't get addressed very well, I think. And as I'd moved to Wicklow outside of Dublin and I was driving in each day to go to work in Temple Bar, just the divide that I was crossing grew a little harsher and harsher to me every day. And I had started my vegetable garden and I had started milking goats, which was a huge journey of, you know, taking on livestock and the daily commitment of morning and night, especially when you're milking an animal. It was a huge commitment and a huge leap from the life I'd known in Dublin. And I think I was very supported and encouraged by my partner, James, at the time. And I'm very grateful to the support he gave me to kind of let me pursue these passions in a way that, yeah, was really supportive. And I think that I'm finding my tribe more and more every day. And there's something really nourishing and exciting about that. I find a lot of beauty in the community that I find growing around me every day. I'm really inspired by the people that I see all around me.
You know, transitioning to any alternative lifestyle always has this aura of fear and risk around it. And so hearing that about your process and how organic it was and how you found this community coalescing around you and how gratifying it's been. I mean, it sounds like as much as you were in this beautiful creative space in Dublin, now you feel more connected with the land and with people around you. I just love fleshing out that side of the story because it lets us all, for anyone who's been on the fence and wanting to lead more of this kind of lifestyle that you're outlining, it gives us an example and it gives us another perspective on, you know, what that would look like. So I really appreciate you being willing to share about that. That's always one of the most fascinating things to me.
Yeah, thank you. And I don't want to suggest it was an easy thing to do. There was a lot of fear that I had to feel and do it anyway. There was a lot of trusting. And I'm very much actively in this process at the moment, feeling a lot of fear about maybe stepping down this path deeper and deeper every day as I fully embrace and envision the dreams and the life I would like to manifest. There's all kinds of fears and worries and I don't know, it wakes up all kinds of demons inside me, but I do keep coming back to trusting that the universe supports me and that we could all follow what would the world be like if we all found our passions and followed them?
Yeah. And I think you're showing a great example of doing that and how sometimes you just have to push through to follow that thread that's really been inspiring you. And the shifts and changes will happen exactly as they're supposed to. But for people who, I think this is the perfect segue for people then who want to support you and follow your work, where can people find more about Hips and Haws Wildcraft? Where can people find out more about your classes? And then tell us about the future plans as things hopefully open up here more and more in 2021.
Yeah, so best way to find me, I suppose, is just social media. So Facebook and Instagram, Hips and Haws Wildcrafts. On Facebook, my name is Mayfly because that was the name of the shop that I had in Temple Bar. So two words, Mayfly. But under that is my page, Hips and Haws Wildcrafts. I update my Instagram mostly. I really love the image-based ease of sharing information that kind of easily and beautifully. So I am pretty bad at websites. I do have one and it's desperately out of date. And I'd much rather be in the forest than updating my website or doing my tax returns. So these are things that...
Absolutely.
So for the moment, I might say the best place to find me is either of those two places. And I will be offering many events, I hope, this year. I have events live for the end of March for wild garlic season, but it's still unclear whether Ireland will still be in level 5 lockdown. At the moment, we can't travel more than 5 kilometers from where we live, and there's no social gatherings of any kind due to COVID. So I have had a certain hesitation in putting up all my events for the year ahead that usually would be live by now. But through my social media profiles, you can have a link there to all the events as they arise. And I will be transitioning. I am in the moment transitioning to a really exciting and daunting big change in which I'm moving into a tiny home bus. I bought a 1995 Mercedes bus that's been converted to a tiny home, and I'm moving tomorrow into it full time. So it's exciting and daunting and you know, brilliant. It's beautiful. It's a dream manifested that I've had for so long. So I have these visions that perhaps I'll drive around the country and offer my events in a totally new fashion. So you might see me in my bus.
I think you're speaking to a lot of people's dreams, honestly. In this day and age, a lot of us want to find a tiny home or live in a caravan and go around embracing the natural world. And I was talking about the changes that you're going through in your life. And here we are at the precipice of a massive change for you.
Yeah, massive. That's why I kind of mentioned I'm actually terrified of this change, but it's absolutely my dream. And sometimes it's scary, isn't it, to be vulnerable and to trust and to just have a belief that we can follow through on our deepest dreams and maybe listen to our hearts. Sometimes I think the times I wasn't connected, I wasn't able to really hear into what my heart was kind of really trying to tell me. And I've been listening very hard over the last year, and I'm letting that voice speak out, and I'm trying to live in tune with what it's telling me. And I'm terrified. I have no idea what the reality of living in a bus is going to be like, but I guess you can hear that in the next update. It's actually tomorrow I'm moving into it full time. So there will be on my social media, I might share a little bit of that journey in my stories, and hopefully, yeah, bring more foraging and fungi fermenting and events to those of you in Ireland.
Well, that'll be an exciting journey to watch. And I think for a lot of us, faith is one of the most challenging virtues to really embody in our lives, because we have so much fear of the unknown. And sometimes we need to not only have faith that things will align as they're supposed to, you do what you're passionate about, the universe will come to your aid, and also just faith in our adaptability and our ability to manage new circumstances, find new ways to thrive. It's all very hard to imagine until you're living in it. So I'm excited to follow your journey, and I have a feeling that it portends great things and many more people to be reached, many more caravan, wild food hunts. That's really exciting.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, then I'll wrap up with the questions I like to ask all my guests. And I think you'll have some terrific answers for us, because you've got a very unique perspective on things. And the first one may be the most difficult, which is, what is a mushroom you love and why? And I may change this question to be, what is the mushroom of the moment for you, or the fungus of the moment for you? Because I know picking a favorite is probably impossible.
Yeah, it is a very impossible question, isn't it? I suppose, yeah, if I'm honest, then for the moment it's chaga, because I have just ordered a bunch of Siberian chaga from a contact I made online, and he has thousands, hundreds of thousands of birch trees bursting with chaga. And it's a medicinal mushroom that really calls to me. It, like I said, I love it as a mushroom coffee. It's something I would consume quite often. I make a double extract from it as well to use it as a tincture. I like it in my coffee. It has all those immune modulating properties. It has full of antioxidants. It's meant to be very effective as a anti-cancer, staving off cancer kind of remedy. It's something that, yeah, I suppose just being really honest. I might have thought of something more colorful if I, but really for me right now, I'm surrounded by chaga and I like to share this medicine with other people. So I have a post recently in my Facebook page about it, and I'll be sharing it with more people. Now, it's something that we don't forage for often in Ireland. It's very rarely spotted here, but it's a nice thing through these times, I think, as also antiviral properties. And, you know, we all need these sorts of tonics at the moment. So,
yeah, and it's something with a long legacy in different cultures, including Siberia, of medicinal use and just such a unique looking mushroom, bold and powerful, these big black burls on the side of trees. I mean, hard to go wrong. I think everyone has a place in their heart for chaga, to be sure. And then more generally, we've talked a lot about your life changes and your deepening relationship with the wild, but what has a relationship with fungi? What has a relationship with mushrooms given to you? What has that brought to your life, or how has that changed your life?
Yeah, I think I touched on that already. I don't want to be repetitive, but oh my God, the sense of connection that I feel to myself, to the world around me, to this excitement of a lifetime of learning that I'm never going to know it all. So just this hunger in me to keep learning these things, this is so exciting to me. Yeah, just connection. So that's the word for me. And that's what mycelium is, isn't it? It's connecting all the trees. It's connecting all of us. It's this exciting, fascinating network that is making me feel like I'm plugged into the universe. I'm feeling the full blast of vitality of the world around me. And I very much attribute that to fungi. A year ago next week from today, I was flying to the Ecuadorian rainforest, February 2020. And while I was going to Ecuador, I was going to be there for 6 weeks. And I was very much kind of secretly thinking in my brain how much I'd really like to find some way of connecting with mushrooms while I was there. But I was thinking, how will I do that? You know, how is that going to happen? Will I just Google mushrooms in Ecuador or events or workshops? I didn't think I was going to find anything. And I arrived in Quito. I was there for about an hour or two, and I'd taken a photograph of the welcome mat of the door, bienvenido, as I arrived, and I posted on Instagram saying, I've arrived. I'm in Ecuador. I don't know what awaits me. I have a few weeks to kill before the shamanic event that I'm attending in the rainforest. I said something like just the excitement that I'd landed. And within 10 minutes, got an email from someone who had joined my Mushroom Foraging Ireland group. So I assumed he was Irish, but he lived in the middle of the rainforest in Ecuador and invited me to come down to the rainforest and stay with him. Because he had six mycologists visiting from America. One of them was Alan Rockefeller, who was on your show recently, and that I was invited to come for 2 weeks and just explore the Amazonian rainforest and fungi. So I kind of really feel the support of the universe as these things happen.
I mean, does it get more affirming than that? You come to an entirely new place, you didn't necessarily let anyone know, and suddenly there are six mycologists, including the world-renowned Alan Rockefeller, waiting for you to take you through the jungles of Ecuador. I mean, if that doesn't bolster your faith and make you continue down this path, I don't know what would. Wow, that's an amazing, amazing story.
I cannot tell you how amazing it was. It blew my mind, and it was just one of the most incredible experiences of my life, I have to say.
Well, I don't think many people get to have that experience, so that is very fortuitous, and I love how you gave us those insights about connection, especially in the context of someone who had already made that conscious decision to reconnect with nature before you discovered fungi. You know, you had made this conscious decision to move out of Dublin, experience, become more embedded in natural surroundings. And then the sense of connection increased, it sounds like, exponentially when you started understanding this organism. So it just shows the power of connection and that power that mushrooms have. Maybe none the least of which, because mycelium does that, or mycelium's function is a connector. But yeah, really, really potent insight, really potent story. I love that. Thank you for sharing that. And then the last question is another big one that you can take in any direction you like. But what is your greatest hope for our communal society or humankind's continuing and developing relationship with kingdom fungi? What's kind of the highest aspirations that you would like or that you envision for us?
I would love to imagine a world in which we are all more connected to the world around us, the natural world, that we can connect to that before it's gone, you know, we could preserve that, that we could maybe come through some awakening, that the corporations can lose their death grip on us all and on this planet, that we can, I think, with the help of fungi, very quickly turn that around. There's still time if we want it. And the micro-remedial properties of fungi and all the promises and potential there is for saving the planet, you know, there's a million ways in which the world could be changed with all the advances and knowledge we have that we're learning every day about how fungi can save the world and help us. So I'm very moved by the book Radical Mycology. I don't know if you've interviewed him yet. You probably have, and I didn't hear it yet. But that book kind of touches, so does Paul Stamets' work and a lot of books, but about kind of the far-reaching ways in which fungi can clean up oil spills, they can save the bees, they can, you know, we can make packaging solutions rather than polystyrene. We can kind of make fake leather out of mushrooms now as well. The nutritional content of mushrooms as an alternative food source, as a local food source, is something extremely sustainable, very quick growing. There are so many ways in which fungi could be harnessed to create great change. And I think we're only starting to really fully embrace that now. And I would love to see a world in which, before it's too late, we could stop the direction we're going and all reconnect a little deeper. And I think the world would be a very different place.
You know, it may be worn out to say that mushrooms will save the world, but I think inevitably any conversation about far-reaching and holistic solutions to change our world for the better, a central figure is always kingdom fungi and everything that we're learning from their physical constituents and compounds to the ways they challenge human perspectives. You know, there's this kind of social micro-remediation that seems to happen when people connect with fungi. So I think you just elucidated beautifully the hope that a lot of us have and a lot of us want to see. Well, Courtney, thank you so much for coming on the Mushroom Hour, sharing your insights about wild food there in Ireland, deeper insights about sociology, and just sharing your story with us. It's been an absolute joy to speak with you. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Likewise. Really lovely to meet you.